Okay, a few more brief points of preface, just now really just more directly connected to actually beginning Sefer Shoftim. Sefer Shoftim, in a sense, is really beginning of a new story, which, in a way, even though certainly Nach, Navi, begins with Sefer Yeshua, Sefer Yeshua really is the culmination of the story of the Torah. Meaning the Jewish people, it starts with the story of Avraham Avinu being promised Eretz Canaan. The Torah itself ends before the ending. It doesn't actually happen in the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. And Sefer Yeshua is actually the culmination, it's really the end of the story, where the Jews actually move into Eretz Yisrael and conquer it. Shoftim begins the story of the Jewish people living in Eretz Yisrael, which now continues until the end of the Churban, almost until the end of scriptural times. So in a sense, Shoftim is the beginning of the story, and that's why it also starts a bit differently than most other Sfarim. It doesn't directly start with the narrative of what the Sefer is about. Sefer Shoftim begins with a certain prologue, and then with an overview of the Sefer itself. You don't have that in other Sfarim. It's very interesting. It gives you a certain overview of the Sefer itself, which is very fundamental. But it's important to understand, because a big part of what we're doing here is really trying to be able to connect to the background and the reality of what was going on there at that time. So it's important to understand this in order to understand the setting in which Sefer Shoftim is taking place. So where are we? The Jewish people have basically began settling in Eretz Yisrael. They settled in Eretz Yisrael. That's where the story of Sefer Shoftim starts. Yeshua was the struggle of actually settling, and now they settled. And therefore, a new era begins. This is a new story. The story of the Jewish people living in Eretz Yisrael and facing the challenges of living in Eretz Yisrael begins now. So here we have to note an important point, and this really defines for us what the challenge of this first generation of settlers in Eretz Yisrael was. The Jewish people had settled in Eretz Yisrael, but they had not yet completed the conquest of the land. The Canaani were not completely driven out yet. They were still living there. Just at this point, from the material perspective, it wasn't crucial, because at this point the Jews had all settled, basically, pretty much. The Jews had all settled, and now getting the Canaani out was more of a mitzvah than a practical necessity. The Jews were fine. They'd be able to be fine as is. But, whereas up till now, they were fighting for the capability of settling in Eretz Yisrael, now what hung over them was Hashem's command. You must purge the land of the Canaan, of all the different nations living there. And that's where they are now. They're okay. And now, can they finish the job? Maschil b'mitzvah oimim lo gemar. When you begin a mitzvah, you expect it to complete it. And this was really the mission of that first generation in Eretz Yisrael. And that's what we're going to be focusing on now. So, therefore, we're also about to see a different style, which is how Sefer Shoftim begins, in what was going on up till now and the continuation. Up until now, the Jewish people were fighting as one army, conquering the land. At this point, that changed. The Jewish people were basically settled in the land. Now it was an issue of cleaning out the different territories, and this was an issue of each shevet to do its share, its territory. Each shevet was meant to deal with its own territory. At this point, it wasn't necessary to have all the Jews together fighting. Each shevet is meant to clean out its own territory. Now let's just understand, why was this so important? Why was this a mitzvah? And not just a mitzvah, but we see that the Torah itself, already Moshe Rabbeinu, well before they went into Canaan, was busy admonishing, make sure you clean the land out of all of its residents, all of its inhabitants. Lo yisechayek kol neshama. Don't leave anybody alive. This was the expectation. This was the charge. Why was that so important? So the truth is, the answer, in a basic way, is obvious to any of us. It was so important because we know that they were a rotten bunch, and Hashem didn't want their influence ruining the Jewish people. But we have to understand that on a much more profound level. We have to understand that that is actually a fundamental function of the Jewish people in every generation. As we've been learning, Hashem took the Jewish people, made them into His nation, which means this is not another nation of the earth that lives basically like everybody else and does its mitzvahs, but this is a nation that lives on a completely different plane. We discussed that a little bit last week. But this is a nation that lives on a completely different plane, meaning the reality of the rest of the world, the norms of the rest of the world, have nothing at all to do with the Jewish people. Our lifestyles don't resemble the lifestyle of the rest of the world in the slightest. Our pastimes don't resemble their pastimes. We're living on a completely different place. Now this is tough, because this means that we're resisting the pull, the current of the entire rest of the world. Now you might ask, well, okay, each nation is unique. Each nation has its individual characteristics. Why are we saying that we're struggling? Every nation is struggling against the rest of the world. No. That's the whole point. When it comes to pleasure, when it comes to having a good time, when it comes to pastimes, when it comes to general standards, the world is basically all the same. There are certain particulars, but the world is basically the same. Standards, you see today, right? Where standards drop, it drops across the board, across the globe. The good times, the fun, that's also basically global. And it's always been that way. The Jews were meant to be on a completely different planet. Completely different planet. Everything about the Jews is different. That's also how the Mepharshim explained, Haman complains to Achashverosh, they'll say, Hem Shainois Mikol Am. We're talking about a king who ruled over 127 different nations. Right? Every nation is different than every nation. Right? No, but Haman's point is, by these Jews, that's an ideal. That's what they believe in. They consider themselves aloof. And it's true, he was right. We are meant to keep aloof. We see Avraham Avinu made a principle out of this. And this was meant to be a principle that the Jewish people live by. And therefore Hashem is saying, it is crucial that your environment sits. Yes, you're meant to be living on a completely different plane with a standard that's way above all the rest of them. It is crucial that your environment be completely sterile. Now just in order to put this into perspective, I want to read a little bit of Rambam. By the way, I guess you've noticed by now that our focus here is not going to be covering ground. We're going to move while making sure that we get all the background we need. But I just want to bring this home with the Rambam, which basically lays this out as a very fundamental hashkafa of the Jewish people in general, as we'll discuss. Derech b'riyaso shel adam. The nature of a person is li'es nimshach b'dei oisav u'b'masav, that he is influenced both in mentality and in behavior achareyav v'chaveyav, by his society. This is inevitable. V'noyeg k'minag anshei medinasav, and he behaves like the people around him behave. Lefikach, tzorich odom lischaber latzadikim. Therefore, a person has to make a point of associating with tzadikim. Veleishev etzel achachamim tamid, and to always be in the company of the wise. Kedei sheilmad mimaaseihem, so that he learns from their deeds. Veyisrachek min harshoim ha'holchim b'choshech, and must keep away from the Rishayim who go in the dark, kedei shelo yilmad mimaaseihem, so as not to learn from what they do. Now, v'chein, now this is important, v'chein, im hayah, b'medina shemin hagay se'aroim, if a person lives in a province where the standards are bad, and the people do not live in an upright way, move to a place where the people are righteous and they act right. Meaning it's very important to live in an environment and surrounded by people that share your ideals. Well, first it's important that you have the right ideals, but it's very important to live around people who share your ideals. For a person to say, yes, I'll live here, but I'm strong enough, is a mistake. It's a mistake, and it'll be considered negligence on his part if he feels he can allow himself that. He's not saying Gidin or Goyim. He's saying people who are doing the right thing or people who are not. Jews or Goyim. Now, generally speaking, for a Jew, you're not going to, if you're going to live among Goyim, you're not going to have people who share your ideals. Obviously. But the point is, even among Jews, to make a point of associating with people who are going in the direction that you want to be going in, because otherwise, you will inevitably be influenced. Now, when I say influenced, I mean even that you can know that they're wrong and you live higher than them. But their standards will influence yours, meaning you'll ultimately start using their standards as a barometer and knowing, yes, I have to be better than them, but look, I am better than them. So you might not be living like them, but their standards are definitely influencing you. Now, this is something that we are all subject to. The fact that we have been in Golus for the last 2,000 some odd years has influenced us in this way in a big way, to the extent that we're not even sensitive to it anymore. We don't realize how influenced we are by it anymore. But it was so important to Hashem that we live in such a sterile atmosphere that everything in the world around us is completely, we are completely oblivious to. And now listen to this. Okay, the Rambam says, 1,000 years ago, right? Less than that, right? 800 years ago. The Rambam says, if all the areas that you know of are, the standards are bad, as it is in our times, Rambam, 800 years ago, okay? Or if you are unable to move to a place where they have the right ideals, whether because the road is dangerous or because you're physically not fit for the trip, live in seclusion, live by yourself, don't be a part of society. Like it says in the pasuk, yishev badot v'yidoyim, live alone and keep quiet. And if they're so bad that they won't let you live here in peace, unless you will be a part of their society and you'll be with what they're doing, go out to the caves and to the thickets, v'lamid boros, and to the deserts, v'yanig atzmoi b'derech hatoy, and do not allow yourself to be drawn in the wrong path. So in other words, the Rambam is laying down what is actually a fundamental hashkafa, which we saw Hashem insisting upon from the earliest of times. And this was a principle that Avraham Avinu lived by. Already we start seeing the originator is, be very, very careful to make sure that your environment is sterile. So again, we have to acknowledge the fact that today that's not so. We're not living in a sterile environment, and that we are very much affected by that. To an extent that it's hard for us to even discern where elements of foreign influence are in our lives and mentalities. But, and therefore it's also difficult for us to appreciate how critical Hashem considered it that the Jews be completely aloof and completely free of the encumbrance of any foreign influence. The reason we find this so hard to appreciate is because we have never seen, I don't think we never seen, but you rarely see what a Jew who is completely uninfluenced looks like. And to see the difference in standards, I've probably seen a few. seen is one thing, but to actually know. I've known one or two or three people who mamish, and
it's black and white. Most, even this environment, you have a lot of great shurim and tzaddikim, and you also have that influence.
That's true. That's true. And that's, and that is really part of the point that I'm making. And here is mamish where we're coming on to the beauty of the sigi we're about to begin. Ibn Nechemiah is saying, even in a frum area, there's different types of people. So the answer to that is, on the theoretical level, certainly not practical. But on the theoretical level is, no! Make sure that on you're the block only of idealists. Let's remember, the term is not frum, the term is not charedi, the term is not whatever term you'll use, whatever socio, the term is people who share your ideals. That's the term. Again, assuming, first make sure you have the right ideals, people who share your ideals. Now, let me just finish. Now that's how it should be. Practically, this is very difficult. But in the beginning of time, Hashem was expecting the Jews, first of all, to completely shut out anything foreign, and second of all, to ensure that the entire Jewish nation was permeated with these ideals. Now, of course, if we're talking about this today in a practical level, completely theoretical. Not completely theoretical. You can still try to make it as possible as you can, but we'll be appreciating exactly what it was that Hashem was expecting of the people of those times. Oh, and that's the famous story where somebody asked the Chazon Ish, how can you live in any but Sabmarov? How can you live here? How can you live anywhere? What? What's that? Oh. Oh, it's the same idea. Oh.
He says, no, I want to be here.
Oh, that's right, same idea. Two very similar episodes. Right, that's the story of the Dubna Magid. The Vilna Gaon used to always ask the Dubna Magid to give him Musa. So one time the Dubna Magid told him, yes, you're very great, but what's the Chachma? You sit in your room, the Vilna Gaon used to even keep the shutters closed all the time. Yeah, absolutely airtight. Nothing at all from the outside world. And he said, you sit in your room, you don't step outside, what's the Chachma? And the Vilna Gaon answered, I'm not looking for Chachmas, I'm looking to be spiritually safe. And along the similar lines, when the Satmar of is the Chazon Ish, how can you afford to live in such a society? Why don't you move out to the Midbaris, like the Rambam says? Move out to the desert. The Chazon Ish said, for us, the Beis Medrash is the desert. But that means something tangible. It means, yes, basically try as much as you can to detach from what's going on around you and focus all of your activities into the Beis Medrash. But again, this is on for us today. Now we're stepping back to the time, and this is really how Sefer Shoftim begins. We're stepping back to the time where Hashem, where it was possible for this to be implemented on a nationwide scale, and this is what Hashem wanted. This is what Hashem wanted. This, by the way, is also the Pshat. What is the Pshat when we find that Hashem considers the whole nation responsible for the sin that one person did in the privacy of his home? Achan, right, we saw this week? When Achan stole that one thing, a couple of things, two things, three things. Hashem said, Chata Yisrael. Why? So we said, yes, that's an obvious style to magnify the chet. But what indeed is the accusation against Chal Yisrael? And it's mind-boggling, but these are the standards that Hashem expected. And this is what the Jewish people were in that time. Hashem said, my claim against you is that the atmosphere should have been charged with a higher level of Yiras Shamayim, to the extent that an individual could not have been able to do this in the privacy of his own home. These are the standards of the times of Tanakh. We're starting to get a little bit of an idea of what we mean when we say that we're talking about a completely different plane, completely different level, completely different set of standards. And it's mamish, this is the atmosphere with which we begin Sefer Shoftim. because this was really the mission of this generation, again, to actually implement that and make sure that they completely drive out any of the nations around. So, like I said again, we're changing our methodology. We will actually be reading the Pesukim inside. But again, as with the other Shiurim, you won't need a Sefer. You'll be fine without one. I guess you already get an idea that the actual Pesukim are going to be a small percentage of my talking. Okay. Vayehi acharei mos Yeshua. And it was after Yeshua died. Vayishalu b'nei Yisrael b'adonai le'mor. And the Jewish people consulted with Hashem asking, Mi ya'ale lanu el haknani b'tchilo lehilochim lo. Okay, now Yeshua is gone. We still have a lot of Canaanim to deal with. There's still a lot of cleansing to do. Who should be the first tribe to go fight the Canaanim? Meaning, what's the question? Each tribe can get to work. No. There was a bit of a delicate situation here right now. As long as Yeshua was alive, Yeshua led the battles. Everybody knew that Yeshua was untouchable. Now that Yeshua died, the Jews lost a little bit of their formidability. And therefore, the Jews realized that the first battle after Yeshua's death is going to be a critical battle. Because if they lose this battle, after Yeshua had been basically an invincible leader, he had one tiny loss. And after that, it was straight successes. If they would lose this battle, that would be a terrible blow to the morale of Jewish people, and it would be a terrible lift to the morale of all the nations. And therefore, it was very important that this first shot after Yeshua is dead should demonstrate that the Jews are still the same. And therefore, they wanted to consult. Who is it that should lead us out? Which tribe should be the first one? As we said, the way it's going to be working now is that each tribe is responsible for clearing out its own territory. So the question is, which tribe should begin? Which tribe can we put all of Klal Yisrael has to put their eggs into that tribe's basket now? We desperately need a smashing victory right now. Who should do that? Vayemer Adonai Yehuda Yale. And Hashem said, let Yehuda go up. Hinei nosati es ha'oretz biyodoi. I have given the land into his hand. So first of all, let's note that already in these psukim we're seeing the drop after Yeshua's death. In Yeshua's time, there was never a situation where the Jewish people as a whole were confused, and there was a general, what should we do? And let's figure out the answer. Yeshua was always there providing the word of Hashem. Now you may remember how we discussed, and here we're seeing this pattern repeating itself again and again. How in the times of Yeshua, the people who remembered Moshe thought, look what we've come to. It's like Chazal say, Moshe was like the sun, Yeshua was like the moon. And therefore the elders of that generation felt that this isn't the real thing. Yeshua suffered from lack of appreciation. He was not properly appreciated since he came in the, what's it called, the coattails of Moshe Rabbeinu. And after Yeshua died, immediately it hit the Jews that all were they in a good state with Yeshua. At the end of the day, things were clear. There was never a question about anything. Yeshua represented Hashem for them the same manner that Moshe did, not on the same level. With Moshe, it was Pel, Pel, Daber, boy. And that's what they were so conscious of. With Yeshua, it's not quite that same connection. But now there wasn't even that. Now, Yeshua is dead, and the Jewish people are a chicken without a head. And all of a sudden they said, whoa, we were secure in Yeshua's times. This was once again the pattern of, and you have it, you don't appreciate it because you remember what was. And you need it to be taken away in order to suddenly appreciate, oh, we actually did have it very good then. Yes, Chazal tell us. Moshe was like the sun, Yeshua was just like the moon. But imagine what happens when the moon disappears also. That's what happened now. The period of the Shoftim, Chazal say, was like the stars. No more moon either. Once there's no moon, you stop complaining about not having the sun. Now you say, one minute, last night we had the moon. Now we're already on to the period of the stars. But yet, the period of the Shoftim, the Chochmah would now be not to say, oh, well, we should have appreciated Yeshua while he had it. This is really something that's relevant in every generation. Yes, yes, when you lose what you had, you... But have the Chochmah, have the Seichel to take note of what you have at this time. At the Lamaisa, throughout the period of the Shoftim, the Jews were in a very, very glorious state, as we'll be seeing soon. So therefore, again, they're asking Hashem, who should be the one to lead us? And the answer is Yehuda. This also manifests the difference. It wasn't a situation anymore where there was a leader who completely bore on his shoulders, at least at this point, all the Jewish people. Now a tribe is being named as the leading tribe. There will be Shoftim, but nothing will come close to what Yeshua was.
Who asked the question? Everybody is confused. Who was the leader?
That's a question that the Mepharshim struggle with. Who asked this question? And how they asked this question? The answer is that they asked the Urim Betumim. But who asked the Urim Betumim? The Maisa, the answer is that the Sanhedrin. There was a Sanhedrin. Yes, Yeshua was the leader, but there always was a Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin asked the Urim Betumim. It was serving in general as the leader in between. So they see what to do. Okay. And Hashem's answer is Yehuda should be the one to do it. And now, as we're going to see, Yehuda was proved themselves worthy of the job. Because again, what was the challenge here? Okay, there was the challenge as far from the material aspect. It was like we said before, it's important to win this battle because otherwise things will get dangerous. Right, we'll start having intifadas. But let's remember that there was also a spiritual agenda here, and that is make sure you completely cleanse the area. Right? So, as far as Hashem was concerned, as far as the Jewish people were concerned too, success in this battle meant two things. Those who are going to see it through to the finish, and who's going to actually win. So therefore, what was actually being asked here was two things. First of all, who's going to get the victory? But second of all, which Shevet should be deemed the most conscientious? Which will be the most energetic? Which will be the one that won't stop after they feel that they've basically done the job and they have things secure? We'll see soon. It was a big challenge to keep fighting and keep fighting and keep fighting. War is wearying. And people want a break after a while. And therefore, this was a big challenge. Yes, they were meant to spend the generation ridding the land of the Canaanite. But that's, anyways, not something. It's like we say, we're supposed to spend our lives learning Torah, right? But that is not, it's a vague chiyuv, because it has to be factored in with all kinds of other areas of life. You have to eat, you have to sleep, you have to spend time with your wife, you have to spend time with your kids, you have to make a living, and you have to learn Torah. And how do you, it's very hard for a person to be able to say, I learn exactly the right amount. It's very hard to define. That's the sort of chiyuv that this was, and that was part of what was challenging about it. It wasn't black and white. You fight from 9 to 5, then you go home and have supper. Of course there are going to be breaks. And it's very, very dependent on different circumstances. How much time should they spend fighting? And therefore there's also a lot of room for wishy-washy. And there's a lot of room for rationalization. We need a 2-month break now. Do you need a 2-month break from the fighting or a 1-month break? So the question is, who's going to also serve it as an example? And the alacrity and the conscientiousness of going about this with determination and not stopping, and serving as an example for the rest of Klal Yisrael as to how the job ought to be done. And the answer is Yeshua. The answer is Yehuda. Now, I'm noting this because we're going to come back soon as we go on to see how Yehuda proved themselves worthy. But, okay, Yehuda is named for the job. Vayomer Yehuda l'Shimon Achiv. Yehuda says to his brother Shimon, in other words, the leaders of the tribe of Yehuda said to the leaders of the tribe of Shimon, Alei iti begoroli. You, come and fight along with me on my share. V'ni lochama b'knani, will battle the Knani. V'alachti gam ani itcha begorolecha. And I'll also go with you and fight alongside you for your share. V'yelech itoy Shimon. And Shimon went along. Now, why Shimon? So this just technically, Shimon, as we've already learned in the past, Shimon did not have their own distinct share in the land. Their share was basically integrated in Yehuda's. And therefore, Yehuda was basically saying it makes sense for us to make an alliance. Instead of me fighting for the general territory and then you fighting for the pockets, let's just all fight together. Okay. Now, Vaya al Yehuda. So Yehuda went up. Vayitena doinoyes haknani vaprizi biyodam. And Hashem delivered the Knani and the Prizi into their hands. Vayakum bevezek aseret alofim ish. And they smote them in Bezek, 10,000 people. So, yes, Yehuda goes ahead and they got that victory they so desperately needed. Yehuda's first campaign, Yehuda's first battle, was a smashing success. They wiped out the Knani in Bezek. Vayimtzuus Adoni Bezek bebezek. They found Adoni Bezek. In Bezek, Adoni Bezek was the king of Bezek, the king of this area. Vayiloch Amuboy, and they fought him. Vayakuis HaKnani Ve'es HaPrizi. And they smote the Knani and the Prizi who inhabited the area. Now listen to this. Vayonos Adoni Bezek. This king, Adoni Bezek, fled. Vayirdifu Acharov. And they chased him. Vayirchazo Oisoi. And they caught him. Vayikatsitsu es behoinois yodover aglov. And they chopped off the thumbs of his hands and of his leg, of his feet. Does that sound pleasant? This should raise eyebrows. Is this what the Jewish people are meant to be doing? What? Should he have? That's all, it's the same question. So David HaMelech will deal with there. But one might say, this is the superficial approach. One does say, people do say, yes, in those days the standards were barbaric and that's the way it worked. That's true. In general, the world standards were barbaric in those days. Even so, we'll see that this was not mamish standard procedure. Even, before I should say that even in general, this was not mamish standard procedure. In fact, more standard procedure was to spare the king's life. Wipe out the whole nation, but spare the king's life for a very selfish reason. Who was in charge of the army? The king. He knew that if one day he's caught, it's much better that universal standards be the kings are spared. All the kings like that, and therefore all the kings issued, that was the general mahalach. Okay. But, whatever it is, this is what the Jews did. Now, so first of all, we have to, again, establish that this is only a legitimate question. We do have to address the question, how could this be done? And was this standard practice? So, what's that?
Did he let him live?
That we'll see in the next part. But, so the answer to this is that this is definitely not standard Jewish practice, maybe standard practice in the world in general at that time. Again, like I said, even that's questionable. But even if it was standard practice in the world in general at that time, this definitely was not standard Jewish practice, and not only that, it was not allowed. This was not halachically acceptable. It was forbidden for Jews to act in this way. If we want a proof to this effect, later in Malachim, we see that the Jews were known to the nations around them as the most compassionate kings in the area. It says about Achav, known as one of the worst Jewish kings, about Achav later it says, that when he defeated the army of Aram, and the king of Aram was fleeing, and he was in a desperate situation, so his servants told him, you'll be better off surrendering yourself to Achav, because the kings of Israel are known to be compassionate kings. So therefore, no, it's clear that even the goyim around knew that Jewish kings maintained a different standard of humaneness. And therefore, this is definitely a deviation from normal Jewish standards. Why did they do this? So let's continue the next puzzle. How did Adoni Bezek say to that? How did he take to that? What were his comments on what happened? So listen to this. Vayomer Adoni Bezek. Adoni Bezek said, this was his response to having his thumbs chopped off. Shivim melachim bahoinos yedeim veraglem nikutzatim hayom melaktim tachas shulchani. Adoni Bezek noted the irony. He said, I had 70 vanquished kings with their thumbs chopped off, picking crumbs under my table. Aha. So, they knew who they were targeting. This was Adoni Bezek's standard practice. And listen how he continues. Kasha osisi ken shilam li Elohim. What I did, Hashem paid me back. Vayivu Yerushalayim, they brought him to Yerushalayim, vayomos sham, and he died there, natural death. Whether it was then, or whether it was 40 years later, we don't know, but this is what happened. So the Mefarshim put this into the following perspective. We already mentioned this back in Sefer Yeshua. The Jews were not just on a conquest campaign, but the Jews were actually bearing the word of Hashem. They were bearing the standards of Hashem. They came not just on a campaign of conquest for their own purposes, but they came on a campaign of vengeance. These people had, as we know, the nations of Canaan had earned their destruction. And therefore the Jews were coming as the messengers of Hashem to mete out His punishment. So it wasn't just that Hashem granted them this land, and the way to take the land is conquer the area. No, they were coming to bring Hashem's retribution. Hashem let these nations get away with more and more and more, until Hashem said, enough, these people are now going to bring the nekama, to bring the revenge that I have coming to these people, to the Canaan. This is what was going on. And therefore, for example, right, we know that Rachab was praised for having taken in the spies. At first glance, even though we're Jews and we go for the Jews, we shouldn't look at that as a virtuous act. From her perspective, it's treachery. Why is she praised for doing what she did? Even when the Jews let her live, because they had to let her live, they should have kept a mile away from her. This is a woman who turns her back on her people. Isn't that despicable? But the answer is no. When we understand that the Jews were not just coming as a conquering army, and she wasn't just looking out for her back. The Jews were coming with a banner of standards. The Jews were coming with, this is right and wrong. This is Hashem's sense of right and wrong, and we're coming to implement that. And we're coming to bring Hashem's punishment to those who were evil. Rachab identified, she connected to that whole new set of standards. That was the righteousness of what she did. Sure, she felt loyalty to her people, but she saw this is the emes, and for the emes she stood up. So this is what was going on here too. This person had a personal cheshbon coming to him for Hashem. According to some of Hashem, they didn't even know that. Hashem made it be such that they should do this for some reason. They got it into their heads to do this thing. But the Mefarshim saying, no, this was conscious. They were meant to do this to him because they were bringing the Midah Keneged Midah of Hashem. This person was unusually cruel, and therefore they bought the punishment of Hashem. And now we're saying an amazing thing. It's not just that, but he himself noted this. He himself acknowledged this. He realized that they were coming, not treating him just as a defeated monarch, but they were coming bringing the punishment of Hashem. He had a flash of realization. When he actually had his thumbs cut off, it hit him. His own wickedness hit him. This is natural anyways. But still, it takes a sensitive person, which Adoni Bezek apparently was not, to be able to say, you know what, I deserve this. Usually a person who does cut off 70 people's thumbs, when it happens to him, he just tries to get you back. But for a person to say, I deserve this, that requires a certain sensitivity, a certain conscientiousness. And he was hit with that at that time. It was a flash of inspiration. What? It was a flash of realization of emes that he had. And therefore, the Jews saw this. Hashem acknowledged this. He was allowed to live. They brought him with them to Yerushalayim. He was allowed to live. And he died a natural death. He was not executed. Why? Because of this, call it tshuva, but that's what it was. It was a realization, it was an acknowledgement of the emes, and therefore he was allowed to die a natural death, which, like we say, may have been immediately because of his wounds, may have been a long time later. One of the Mefarshim actually takes this a giant step further. He says, says that Adoni Bezek became a ger tosha, that's why they let him live. He was so struck with that realization, with that acknowledgement of the MS, by experiencing it on his own flesh, that he said what I did was wrong, not just in the sense of resignation, but he really acknowledged that what I did was wrong. After he felt it happened to him, he had true remorse, and he committed to now live as a Ger Toshav. He was brought to Yerushalayim, and he lived the rest of his life as a Ger Toshav.
Is that Yerushalayim? I thought Yerushalayim got its name later.
What's that?
Didn't Yerushalayim get its name later when David took it over?
They first completed the conquest of Yerushalayim later, but no, it was called Yerushalayim earlier as well.
What does it literally mean that he had 70 other kings that he had?
He had defeated 70 kings in the past.
And
the standard procedure was they took each one's fingerprints and then they chopped off his thumbs. That was part of the. They chopped off his thumbs, and they were left to pick crumbs under his table. That was their food. It was a cruel person. Yeah. Okay. So now, the next step. Vayilochamu b'nei Yehuda. Now, Yehuda just celebrated a victory, and they continue immediately on to the next campaign. Yehuda, we're seeing, are actually carrying out energetically Hashem's expectation. One campaign to the next, that's what we're going to see now. There was no letting up. It was one to the next. They didn't stop until they were done. So now let's see. Vayilochamu b'nei Yehuda b'Yerushalayim. Then, Yehuda fought, they took up the fight against Yerushalayim. And they captured it. And once again, they captured it. They didn't stop there. After you capture it, that's enough to actually go ahead and now wipe out the whole city. It's a whole new campaign. That's and they set the entire city aflame. They destroyed the entire city. They razed it to the ground. Now, like Rav Nachemya just pointed out before, we see much later in Tanakh that the conquest of Yerushalayim was completed only in David's time. So yeah, the Mepharshim say that there were different areas of Yerushalayim that were conquered at different times. We'll see this actually mentioned soon. But okay. What's that? Yeah. Next. They're not finished. The Achar. Again, one campaign to the next. This is Yeshua living up to Hashem. Sorry. Yehuda living up to Hashem's expectation. Serving as the perfect example for the rest of the Shvatim. Then Yehuda descended to battle the Knani, Yesheva Hor, Vanegev Ashvelo, who dwelt in the mountain, in the south, and on the plains. And on, Vayelech Yehuda al Knani. Let's note, a very energetic, ongoing campaign is being described here. It probably was many years. Then they moved on, they went to the Knani, Hayeshev Bechevron, who dwelt in Hebron. The Shem Hebron, the Funim Kiryas Arba, which had previously been called Kiryas Arba, Vayaku es Sheshai ves Achiman ves Talmai. And they smote three giants who lived there, Sheshai, Achiman, and Talmai. Now, it's important to notice because right now this is just starting to sound like, you know, okay, this and this and this and this. But we're going to be contrasting it later to all the rest of the Shvatim. None of the rest of the Shvatim are going to sound like this. And really what we're seeing here is the reason Hashem chose Yehuda. None of the Shvatim was it city, 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 city. It was they conquered this, they sat around, they didn't conquer that. So let's note that. Vayelech misham al yeshvei Dvir. From there they moved on to the inhabitants of Dvir. V'shem Dvir lefanim Kiryas Sefer. That had been called Kiryas Sefer in the past. Now here we go back. There's a bit of an overlap here with Sefer Yeshua, because again, as I already said, really, this is not really beginning the narrative of Sefer Shoftim. It's really kind of just giving us the background against which Sefer Shoftim starts. So there is some overlap here with Sefer Yeshua. Now we see an incident that actually took place back in the times of Yeshua. They came to fight this city called Dvir, or Kiryas Sefer, and they had a hard time conquering it. Vayemer Kalev, and Kalev said, Asher yakeh es Kiryas Sefer ulekado. Whoever can manage to fight this city, Kiryas Sefer, and conquer it and capture it, then asati lo yisach soviti leisha. I will grant him my daughter Achsa as a wife. Now, we've already discussed back in Sefer Yeshua, we'll mention it again briefly now, since it's being repeated here. Is that why you're looking puzzled? What's that? It was a suburb of Hebron. This area was a suburb of Hebron.
And what's it called?
Kiryat Sefer, or Devir. This is not our Kiryat Sefer. Yeah, it's a suburb of Hebron.
There's more than one beit shem.
What's that? Right, right. So now, as we've already discussed back in Sefer Yeshua, there was actually something going on under the surface here. The reason they had a hard time conquering the city was because after Moshe's death, there was a big confusion about many of the halachas that Moshe had transmitted. And this was part of the trauma that they had experienced back after the death of Moshe. They told Yeshua, okay, you're Moshe's successor. So do what Moshe did. Go to Hashem, ask him, and come back and tell us. But we had already reached a point in history where it didn't work that way. Only Moshe transmitted Torah Min HaShemayim. Once Moshe finished transmitting the Torah Min HaShemayim, there was no such thing anymore of getting Torah Min HaShemayim. From now on, Torah is completely subject to anything that needs to be determined in Torah has to be determined by the analysis of the Chachamim. There's no such thing anymore of coming and saying, I have a message. And therefore it didn't work. And therefore, they had 3,000 question marks. I'll just mention again, very briefly, if anybody's interested in hearing this more at length, I will never have the relevant shiurim from Yeshua put up. By the way, once I'm on this, just so I don't forget, in parentheses, there are now, I think, 3 shiurim posted. Bezos Hashem, by tomorrow there will be 5 shiurim posted that are very, very good, just as introductory shiurim to, if you want to get the whole picture of what we're doing here, right, you can check it out. But whatever it is, in short, yes, this was a period in history from this point on where Torah is not supposed to come in Hashemayim anymore. Why? For the purpose of ensuring the continuity of Torah. Meaning, there's no such thing as a person coming and saying, Rabbosai, I have a message from Hashemayim, and here I'm going to do a miracle or two or three to prove it. People, miracles to prove messages from Hashemayim, we say what Rabbi Yeshua said to Rabbi Eliezer. Right? When Rabbi Eliezer wanted to prove his halachic point, when they were debating in the Besmedrash, he said, well, if I'm right, let that carob tree prove my point. And the carob tree lifted up. And Rabbi Yeshua said, what bearing does a carob tree have on our discussion? Lev Hashemayim. So that's what was going on here. So Yeshua was basically at a loss. And they needed somebody to come and reinstate those halachas. Now, that manifested in a very physical way because as long as they were stuck here, they couldn't conquer that city. The military success of Klal Yisrael, and this is a point that's very much being contested today, but the military success of Klal Yisrael depends on a solid base of Torah learning. That is the battery upon which the military machine can run. This was something that Jews knew up until today. That's why, for example, Yoav told David, I go out to war if I know that you're back in Yerushalayim studying Torah. And therefore, the Mefarshim say an interesting thing, that different areas of Torah, Torah basically represents the creation. Different areas of Torah represent different parts of the creation. This area, Devir Kiryas Sefer, was somehow the physical manifestation of those areas of halacha that were now not clear. And as long as those areas of Torah could not be recaptured, Devir couldn't be captured either. And therefore, what seems like a reckless statement on Kolev's part, Kolev says, whoever can capture Devir, I'll give him my daughter as a wife. What happens if some big brawny guy comes and he manages to do the job? You determine who's going to be a good husband for your wife by a person who's a good warrior? That's not a good way of determining a husband for your wife. But no, the real struggle for your daughter, the real struggle here was who's going to capture the areas of Tyre that will make it possible to subdue this city. And therefore, Kalev was saying, if a person can come and prove himself to be basically a Gadol HaDor, I'll give it my daughter. That was really the challenge here. And that's what happened. Bayokido Osniel ben Knaz, Achi Koleva Kotar Nimir. Who did capture it? Osniel ben Knaz. Who was he? It was actually Kalev's younger brother. So he captured it, meaning that he sat down and he studied these areas, this Torah. And he came up with all the answers to the questions. And then the city of Vir fell like a pile of toothpicks. And yes, Vayiten lo yisachsa bita liyisha. So he granted him Achsa, his daughter, as a wife. Now, as we saw in Yeshua, the Navi sticks in here what seems like a very side point, a technical point. Vayehi bivaya. And as she was coming and becoming married to Osniel, vatisitehu lishol me esavio hasodeh. And she pushed her husband to allow her to request from her father a field. Vatitznach me alachamor. Meaning, okay, actually we'll leave this part of the discussion for next week. We've ran out of time. But okay, we didn't start this pasuk yet. No fields. Next week, Be'ezos Hashem. Okay. So again,